I've just been having a look at on Google about 1990s, just refreshing, because this is obviously the year that I kind of when I started to use my brain and actually listen to music properly and stuff.
Yeah, and it's sadly me being quite a bit older than you, that it was pretty much a decade I did the same, because I was a bit of a slow developer.
I think I would just be completely jealous of the fact that you got to go to gigs that I was too young to go to. So, you know, it swings and roundabouts. So, yeah.
I missed out on the big, but we'll get to that, I'm sure.
So 1990s, I it was obviously the big news was obviously the hiatus of Doctor Who started then.
Yes.
And around that time, it was obviously a big time for music. I've you know, obviously I was 8 at the time when in 1990. So for me, going at 1990 was all about the World Cup 1990 for football, and that was amazing. And I that to me is the time I can remember most about the world. It's bizarre. It's almost like my brain was completely open to everything at that point, I can remember.
Yeah, like basically it switched on and you started receiving. Yeah,
completely. Yeah. Before that, there was the modem wasn't switched on. Now it's like, come on.
Based on like telex or something, or a rudimentary fax system. Yeah.
But yeah, but so yeah, I remember loads of stuff about that time. But then, you know, it was. It was obviously quite a big time for rave music and dance music at that time, but I wasn't really in the whole rave scene as a 9-year-old. So, did you dabble in the rave thing? Or?
No, I early 90s was a bit of a kind of turning point for me musically, because for about 1988 until I would say 91, I pretty much exclusively listened to hip hop in my little town in the West Country. I'd been sort of drinking in Public Enemy and EPMD and loads of the like mad fast British stuff that was coming out, like Hijack and Silver Bullet and all that sort of thing, and Ice-T, Tribe Called Quest, tons, absolutely tons. And then around 91, I had the kind of guitar-based music Road to Damascus moment with Nirvana, and that was genuinely pivotal for me. But yeah, I was never really into the rave thing. It was really strange. As I recall at the time, there was kind of, and this is actually from like 91 onwards, like when I was still in school, like in 1990. Like I was like 15 years old and frankly didn't really know a great deal about anything. Vic Reeves' Big Night Out and the odd episode of Absolutely. But basically there were kind of the rave kids, and then there were the kind of indie slash rock kids. And unless you were at the Stone Roses, never the twain met, really.
Well, it was weird because when I was at school, there was probably about 95, there was always this kid at my school who was from a slightly rougher area, but not too rough. And he used to be like, yeah, I'm into Dre and shit. You know, he used to walk around. And everyone would just be like, What are you talking about?
He's into like heavy haulage with horses. He's in,
and he'd be like, yo. But what he used to do is he was just quite intelligent bloke. But in his downtime from his, you know, being vaguely intelligent, he used to wander around the corridors just like mumbling lyrics. And all you would hear as he walked past would be like, fuck. And it's like, what? Sorry, what?
What?
He said, what? And it was F this and F that. And he'd just mumble all these like, and he'd be like, yeah, I'm into Trace. So when Gangster's Paradise came out.
Yeah.
He was in his element. Everyone was going, oh, you've been into this hip-hop malarkey for a bit. And he's like, yeah, totally, yeah. I'm into Dre, I'm into all that shit and all the different ones. Because I was never into hip-hop, so for me it was kind of like, I was always a bit perplexed by it all.
I'm surprised that you managed to get some kind of like kudos for that, because I was, I think, laughed at. Continuing, it didn't probably help that I had the hair of Ronald McDonald and I was about 3 feet tall. So I was a little clown midget with an NWA 12-inch. And, you know, but I think the kids that, the kind of kids that used to take piss out of me for liking it, eventually their successors got into it. And I kind of had a bit of a smug moment. Yeah, I've been listening to that since like 1988, you know, freshman.
That's what generally happens, isn't it? You know, you'll be into stuff, and then people will go, oh, yeah, yeah. You know, because at the end of the day, everyone just wants to fit in when it's school. Sort of.
Yeah.
But for me, the sort of musical climate didn't change properly for me until probably about 94, 95, because I was at, like, there was this kind of... It was basically, I was critically ignored by the ladies for a long time. I used to wander around just kind of going, all right, and nothing. You know, they didn't even know writers back. So there was this like really bad nightclub that had that we used to go to once a year around Christmas time and have a party there. And they used to have really bad kind of fake trees and stuff like that outside, palm trees and stuff. It was terrible. I think it was called Oz, all dead. You know,
you think they'd have gone with the M theme with a name like that, or Prison. The show wouldn't have been on by then. The HBO thing on. Better have known about that. That would have been
This was post tacky, you know. And, everything was sticking to the floor, but there was always these people outside who would be like, you know, the parents would be dropping off and all that, and then they'd be standing outside just going, seriously, I'm pissed. So, yeah, completely off my face, and like, you haven't drunk anything. It's like, yeah, completely off my face. So I used to just wander around. So I used to have like all the dance music, like Wigfield, Real McCoy, all this sort of stuff banging out. And I basically kept fit by just circumnavigating, right? So just wandering around and people just like not even noticing I'm there, and occasionally kind of going, I quite like this song. And then so you know, it was a strange time, because there was a lot of kind of good kind of what would class as kind of electro dance stuff that was more kind of European, that was kind of acceptable, like Snap and stuff like that, you know, and like Exterminate. I only bought Exterminate because I thought it sounded Doctor Who-y, to be honest with you. And there's lots of stuff like that, but I think that the tide completely changed. Well, for me, round when obviously Britpop emerged and stuff.
Yeah.
And it was a fascinating time, I think, especially when Top of the Pops was still relevant, you know.
Yeah.
And when you had the Blue Oasis thing on telly, it was like, it was a big deal, and everyone knows that the Oasis song wasn't as good as the Blur song, you know. But it was still, it didn't matter, you know.
It was Roll With It, wasn't it?
It was, yeah. And Roll With It was basically just like, it was written on the back of a tab packer, wasn't it? You know, it was terrible.
No, with a pack of B&H, yeah.
Because it did some good stuff, Oasis, obviously, back in the day, but that wasn't one of the best ones. But yeah, so it was a fascinating time. And so where did your allegiances lie, Blue Oasis, then?
Oh, I'm going to give the smart ass answer. Supergrass. Oasis, I saw twice. Back in the day, once, because I grew up near where Glastonbury Festival was, and there were various ways by which you could get yourself in for either cheap or free. One of which was I did a theatre course, and we had like passes for the posh bog in the comedy and theatre tents. And then the other time was because basically my mum used to work for the council, and she had a gig basically just checking the fences, quote unquote. So she used to sneak me and my sister in. I saw them talk, and like on one occasion, they were like, God, you're amazing. And they had, it was one song, Acquiesce, which I think was a B-side, is absolutely their best song. And they pissed it away on a B-side. Yeah, so I could, perhaps nominally Oasis. Blur were okay, but I don't know, found them a bit, not sure.
I know what you mean.
Obviously art school kind of thing. But really, out of the two of them, I was really a lot more into Supergrass and like Caught by the Fuzz, that first single and that. So. Yes. Yeah. Not wanting to be like hipster about it, but kind of neither. But if I had to choose the two, it would have been Oasis, because they seem to have a little bit more kind of heart to them.
Well, the time when I really clicked with Blur was on the album 13, which I'm trying to think when. I think that was around 99, maybe 99, 2000 sort of time.
Yeah.
Where, so it's still fine to have it in the podcast. It's okay,
this is just, this is just 90s.
But yeah, but that was the time when it really clicked with me, because you could tell that the kind of Graham had kind of been allowed to kind of say, hey, I want this sort of bit noisier, and they had a bit more electronics. And the classic album, in the sense of he just split it with Justine Frischmann as well.
Yeah.
So it you know, and they were obviously, you know, they had one really good album, one kind of the second album, which took about 7 years to come out. They were an interesting band because you obviously had people like Echo Belly as well, you know, and there was a few kind of decent bands knocking about. And but like Pulp as well. Pulp emerged after, I think they had been around since when I was born.
Yeah, I think they've been around for about 15 years by the time they've been, which is fair play. That's fantastic. That was back when that you could actually kind of claim dole and be a musician, basically. It was a viable way that you could kind of live and work on your music and claim dole and that. It's impossible now. Everybody, you know, you have to have a job of some kind. You can't just kind of go, right, look, I'm working on a thing, you know. And not everybody that goes through that obviously makes it in that, but like, yeah, that's quite cool.
Well, yeah, it's just especially when you never have someone spend the amount of time that Elastica had, or Portishead or something like that, generally, you know.
Portishead.
Was it 8 years, something like that, in between the second and third album? It obviously Suede, I really like Suede at the time as well. And I remember as well, I majorly peeved off the deputy headmaster at my school because he had this idea, and it was when Romeo and Juliet came out. That's another. We'll go on to films in a bit, but that was a really interesting like postmodern pastiche. That was very kind of the 90s thing.
Yeah,
and a lot of good music on there, like Cardigans and that. But it said if you were going to do Romeo and Juliet again in a different form, how would you do it? So I did this film thing, and I had to do a soundtrack, work out a soundtrack. So he said, well, if you want to, you can either write it up or do it as a diary. So I did it as a literal diary put in all the, and I got that fine on paper. But what they had to do was I had to photocopy every page. he was well annoyed. Oh, he's just like, he just keep going any much farther. I've got much more. I was like, yeah, probably about a couple of months or something to go. But you know, Suede's on the soundtrack. I don't know who they are. Keep well away from us. But it was obviously an interesting time in guitar music terms, and obviously you obviously had dance music getting quite a renaissance with kind of stuff like Trainspotting and stuff. Left Field and Underworld and stuff. Prodigy, obviously Prodigy's 1997 album, Fat of the Land.
Yeah, and one of those ones that crossed, I remember me talking earlier about you got the rock kids and you got the dance kids, and that was kind of the case that crossed over very naturally.
It was a big thing, and then I think when you do that kind of punky sort of dance music, I don't think they ever really built on that album. I think it was like a very much like what we're gonna do with this, you know.
Well, I don't know if I waffled on about George Romero last time we spoke, but the analogy I always use is like basically he with Night of the Living Dead, George Romero kind of accidentally happened upon a bunch of social commentary and stuff. So the next time he goes around to make a zombie film, suddenly he has to make a big thing. So you can arrive at something kind of really, really good just by accident, and then spend the rest of your career trying to do that again. And maybe that's what the Prodigy did. Like, they arrived at this really kind of great kind of organic, you know, sort of mix of kind of punk and lots of like really dirty hip hop and, you know, breakbeat and dance and stuff. And then, they have the reputation as the kind of the sort of punkier, nastier edge, and so they end up just basically repeating that to fade. And so maybe that's what happened with them.
Yeah, it can happen. I mean, for me, obviously, a lot of, I think, my kind of experiences are probably, I was there at the time and I was getting into stuff, but sometimes you think back at stuff and actually kind of analyse it more. Like, say, like Portishead's Emergence, their two albums they did in the 90s were just amazing. It's the same as Tricky as well. I mean, Tricky's Max and Quay is just like, wow, you know. It's like, it's and Porter said for them to come back with a third album so many years late and still be relevant, it just showed how and the sad thing is they almost became like a coffee table type, a dinner party sort of
band. It was because Portishead cropped up on things like This Life and that, and
yes,
you know,
and
very much the middle class set, and actually kind of it belied the fact that actually they're just really, 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 really pretty good.
And they were never going to put themselves forward for being on a dinner party compilation, you know.
I'm sure they won't say no to the money, because that's how you earn you you keep and that, but
oh,
you know,
completely, yeah.
So I don't think they could ever be accused of selling out or anything like that. But they, yeah, for a few years, they were like everywhere and in places where you wouldn't necessarily expect music as kind of like actually quite bleak and somber, as that to go. I mean, if you kind of listen to the elements of it, you've got whacking great big hip hop drums. You've got kind of the theremin, that 50s sci-fi whale, and you've got that kind of spy guitar thing, and then you've got Beth Gibbons and her kind of incredible don't use the word whale because it sounds like I mean it badly, but she's got kind of a, you know, very mournful funereal voice.
Yeah, it's true.
Goth
yeah,
as hell, and everybody loves it. All the mainstreamers love it. It's like, wow.
It was a strange time for music when you, I suppose it happens quite a lot now, but when something goes ridiculously popular, people react to it. I mean, two bands I'm thinking of here are Pulp, with Different Class. They obviously went really big, and then with This Is Hardcore, I really like quite a lot of this, especially This Is Hardcore, the actual single was amazing. And Radiohead as well, with the kind of reaction, kind of the bands being so popular. Then went OK Computer, and it was like, whoa, this is amazing. This is like, it felt like it was recorded in a different world. You know?
Where did the Iron Lung EP come in? Because that was, I remember that being kind of around the time of Nirvana's In Utero, and the track My Iron Lungs, that it kind of seemed like it could have been, actually, it seemed like it could have been from a slightly less punky in a version of In Utero.
Yeah, that was on the Bends. And it's I kind of with the Bends, I never quite got it when it came out. I think I was maybe a little bit too young. And then when OK Computer came out, I was like, and then I watched a documentary called Meeting People Is Easy.
Yeah.
And it all clicked, and I went back and I mean the first album is quite so. I mean, it's a good song, but
it's very kind of like Buffalo Tom, and I think it was just, they used the same producers as a lot of the kind of fairly generic American indie rock bands. So it's kind of got that, it's got a bit of rock to it, and it's got a bit of a jangle to it, but it doesn't go as far as Sonic Youth or anything like that, or Dinosaur. Kind of seems like a bit tepid, and then they go at the Bends, and the Bends had some bits that sounded weirdly like Queen, which is actually kind of in certain corners of the culture in the 1990s a bit of a no-no, oddly.
Well, I mean, Paranoid Android on OK Computer, that was very mimicking Bohemian Rhapsody for the kind of the craziness of it and the different parts to it and stuff, you know.
And Muse had basically later take that whole thing and just kick it out of the park completely.
They took it to another stadium in another world, you know.
Yeah, is it a parallel dimension where everything's much bigger?
Yeah, but he's really small.
That's the irony.
And before I ask you about your, because I think you probably have better kind of knowledge of kind of alternative American music, I'm going to give a notable mention to the band Manson, because they did the album Six.
I
love Six.
Yeah, so. I never had the album, but I remember a couple of singles. I really, really liked Being a Girl, Wide Open Space, the single, which is awesome. Did they do a follow-up?
I'll tell you the full how it went. Basically, they did the first album, Attack the Grey Lantern, and I got that on cassette from the library. Pretty good. It had like Wide Open Space and She Makes Me Bleed and Tax Loss and stuff. Good stuff. Six came out, and Six was just like, they basically had drug problems, depression problems, and it had Tom Baker narrating over an opera singer about the death of Brian Jones.
Crikey.
That was one track, and then they had a break, and then then it went to the next part of the album. It was mad, it's brilliant. But on the front cover, it has a TARDIS, Winnie the Pooh, Tom Baker, and it's just like, it's an amazing front cover.
And I guess the title itself is a reference to The Prisoner.
Yes, indeed.
Yes.
So, And then the third album, they got told to kind of be a bit more pop, and they kind of didn't quite know what to do, and it just really didn't click quite. Half the album was quite interesting, and then it just went, really, what are you doing? Then basically what happened was the bassist stole all their money.
Wow.
While they were recording their fourth album, which was released probably about 6-7 years later by Paul Draper, the singer, but just basically get some money out, really, because obviously he'd fucked off somewhere. And they're talking about getting them back together, but like a lot of 90s bands, I don't know if you noticed, there's been a resurgence recently. It's like Lightning Seeds are playing the Sage Gate set. Space are back.
Oh my god.
Yeah, I mean, Lightning Seeds apparently haven't been away, they've been doing loads of stuff. And before we go to America, Jazz Man from Babylon Zoo with Space Man. Good song.
The most notorious kind of intro ever.
Yeah, the lead guy had the one, yep.
And then the epic bought the single and it was like, okay. I'm not sure I like the rest of this.
But he's notable for his appearance on Brass Eye. So,
yeah, you know, and maybe he's got a few more tunes than the rest of us.
But yeah, in terms of like, obviously, you know, we've got bands like Sonic Youth who built on the kind of success in the 80s and stuff. Which bands were kind of big for you in that, apart from like Nirvana and stuff? Which ones stand out?
Sebado. Going for the obscure one. But they were and they still are my favourite band. Because... oh crikey, I don't know, have we got about 3 hours? But basically they were kind of wuss rock. Kind of still are wuss rock. I mean, they're kind of basically formed partly in the shadow of there are three peaks. Like the classic lineup was Lou Barlow, a guy called Eric Gaffney and Jason Lowenstein. They all swap instruments in that kind of shambolic US punk way. They all share songwriting duties, so it's kind of a Beatles setup where you've got three songwriters rather than like a front guy in a band. Basically, like the band went full time. Lou Barlow used to be the bass player in Dinosaur Jr. And like they all had some fairly wacky interpersonal communication issues. And long story short, Jay Maskus, the lead singer of Dinosaur Jr., told Lou Barlow that Dinosaur were breaking up and that was the end of it. And so Lou kind of thought that was the end of it. And then he finds out a couple of days later that Jay Maskus has reformed the band with another guy on bass. Oh, and by the way, they've just signed to Warner Brothers without him. So it's kind of in the shadow of a massive, great beat. Actually, quite a nasty thing to do. So they were part of the whole lo-fi movement. So a lot of the early stuff is just recorded on guitars with like two or three strings on, sometimes not even on four-track machines, on two-track machines. Hmm. But the songs, they're the most beautiful, beautiful songs, covered in kind of hiss and tape noise and kind of played in weird tunings. But I mean, it's kind of almost like kind of perversely throwing all this weird stuff at these beautiful, beautiful artifacts. And they captured my imagination. And they stayed with me ever since. They're back together and they're kind of doing the reunion. So I think we might actually get a new record out of them after last one they did was 1999. So yeah, very 90s. But yeah, they were and are my favourite band of that era. I was kind of dipped into Pavement a bit here and there, but I never got the same feeling that they kind of really meant it. Whereas like Sebado, it's really, really heartfelt. It's kind of like a slightly spazzy kind of Neil Young, Nick Drake kind of thing. Kind of pretty much the dictionary definition of awkward grace. Really, they were the band that really, really, really made an impression on me. And luckily, I got to see them a couple of times. Sadly, what would have been my favourite never happened because I got bought tickets for a Nirvana show in Cardiff in 1994. And it was rescheduled after Kurt had his overdose in Rome for my birthday. Yeah. And Sebado were the main support. And then what happened, and like, oh, Christ, that would have been like the best show ever. Never got to see it, which is a shame. But I got to see them kind of like their headlining shows quite a few times. Just the fact that I can't actually string a sentence together to describe them. I adore them, probably attests to my devotion to them to an embarrassing degree. Who else from the 1990s? Must have listened to somebody else other than that. But it was really weird. There was like a massive watershed change, like a massive change in my listening habits. So I still kind of listen to hip-hop on and off because like the early 90s, there was 3 Feet High and Rising 90s?
I don't know, be honest with you.
I know Public Enemy's Fear of a Black Planet was 1990s, and that kind of has sort of stayed with me as well.
And one band, just slightly sea change here, but that were mentioned by Tix was obviously McCluskey. They were 90s, weren't they?
Oh, yes!
Yes.
Yeah, but I didn't discover them until way, way after the fact, as is kind of the... Like, the same, I did the same with Swerve Driver recently. Like, I think that's really, I don't know, I think Harry Media might have mentioned them or something like that. I was sort of something on Facebook, you know, the Spotify thing on Facebook, you kind of see.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, I'm sure it's something like that, but I kind of went back to listen to them, and I think remember Bob Mould mentioning them as well at some point. Sugar, that's another band as well that were brilliant. I didn't know Husker Du first time around, but I was very much into Sugar and Pop Blue. Sorry, digression there. But Swerve Driver, bloody amazing. And I just didn't pay them a great deal of attention, probably because they were British and I was a bit of a snob. So I did just listen to American bands all the time.
Really, it's fascinating when you go back to stuff, because like, for me, I never knew of My Bloody Valentine at the time.
No.
But now, listen to stuff like, I've been listening to Loveless tonight, and it just blows my mind, like, how you could release something like that in the early 90s. It just doesn't sound like a 90s.
Did that not bankrupt Creation Records or something?
I believe it did, yeah. That's always an interesting one, because when you hear bands have done that, invariably it's been a good album. So yeah.
It's worth it.
And also going to mention as well, the early to mid 90s was when Mogwai emerged as well.
Yeah.
With and obviously I've got like the compilation EP plus 6, which is like their early stuff, and they're like still blow us away now, but some of their like the first two or three albums are just wow.
Do you know the band Slint?
I know of them, but I've never got into them.
It's kind of, it normally sort of follows if you like Mogwai, I really like Slint as well, and Polvo actually. What I think of it. Polvo, but the thing is, it's like Slint and Polvo. Well, no, Slint I kind of heard of in the 90s. Polvo I didn't discover until 3 or 4 years ago, but they were from a similar era. Oh, so it's because it's easier to get hold of stuff now.
It is indeed. You mean by buying stuff legally? Is that what you're talking about?
Absolutely. Well, I did actually, because I was a member of emusic.com, and there's loads of this stuff on there. Like, you pay like £8-9 a month, and you have a bunch of downloads, so you get like 40 tracks or something like that. But yeah. And of course, you know, by other means, if that's you know, if that's your bag.
Yeah. let's move to TV now. In terms of TV, you've obviously mentioned one, Big Night Out. Was obviously, I've just watched it yesterday as well, and it never gets to the point where I think, oh, this is boring.
No.
It's always got a new layer to it, and it feels like you're part of a bizarre cult, doesn't it? You know,
it kind of did at the time. I remember. Yeah. Like at my school, I think there was one other person that knew of it, and then gradually I think something happened around, I don't know if it was the first in the second series or partway through the first series, because suddenly like everybody knew about them, but for a time it was just like kind of like a really closely guarded secret. But yeah, it does kind of feel like you're part of some kind of cult, as it were.
But even now, when you've almost like the code word to get into this party would be, have you seen The Weekenders?
Yeah.
Get in now, you know, it's almost like that, you know, and if you think about it, Smellery's and Mortimer, you know, was had some amazing moments, he was them too. Then you had Bang Bang as well.
I mean,
you can't knock the club is just immense.
Club's awesome. It's if I'm honest, they do taper off a little bit, but it's still Reeves and Mortimer, and they're still geniuses, genuine proper geniuses.
I think the fame especially went to Vic's head, I think, in around that time, because when they started doing Shooting Stars, it was kind of like they got the chance to do that kind of mainstream game show, Families at War, and then Randall Hopkirk, and yeah, so I think they kind of lost sight of the kind of the random surreal sort of thing.
To be honest, like, they've been, how long have they been doing? Because they've been doing Big Night Out in pubs, haven't they, since the late 80s and that?
Yes.
A good few years for it to kick off. I mean, I suppose you can kind of forgive them a little bit. But just thinking, oh, fuck it, I don't want to mess around with, like, talc powder on my head. you know, I don't want to do talc and turnips again.
it was a lot of good comedy about in the 90s. You know, you've got stuff like Alan Partridge.
Stuff
that stands the test of time, because I think some things haven't really stood the test of time. Like, stuff like The Fast Show was good, but it feels a little dated. Whereas like I'm Alan Partridge is just wow, it's just yeah. perfect, isn't it?
You know? It's just all the way amazing. But knowing me, knowing you with Alan Partridge, the day to day was absolutely phenomenal. Absolutely the Scottish sketch show. Kind of the Scottish Monty Python.
That kind of passed me by a bit, to be honest with you.
Oh man, it's brilliant. If you're ever nearby, I'll press the box set into your hand and instruct you to go and watch it. Oh crikey, who else? Kids in the Hall from the States.
There was Eddie Izzard night on Channel 4.
Yes, yes.
And Skip Watch was one of the things I remember. But yeah, they had the Kids in the Hall film, one of the TV films on, and I haven't seen that much because it hasn't really been shown that much. But,
I think I seem to remember that they only really showed one season over here, but there's about four of them in the States, and when I get some money, if I ever have any money again, I intend to get the whole lot because I love that very deeply, that show.
And obviously, All Hail Chris Morris with amongst other things, Jam.
Yes.
Which is one of the most amusing, scary, disturbing, what the hell's this program ever.
I mean, basically the words, the gush still strike fear into my heart.
Jesus. I mean, I used to tape it. I think it was a Thursday night. And it was always the sort of thing, I think, what have I done? Why have I taped this? Is this really disturbing? And then about halfway through the season, I just thought, I get this now. I understand what he's doing with this. It's not everyone will get it, and they clearly wouldn't ever. But even just like the music as well, the kind of we should be shocked. We haven't mentioned Warp Records and Aphex Twin and Ortega and stuff and Squarepusher.
And actually, by extension, Ninja Tune as well.
Yeah, because you know it's such an important thing. The music on Jam, wasn't it? You know.
Yeah. Because did you ever catch the radio version of it that came out?
Yes,
before?
I've gone to see
Blue
Chat. Yeah. I don't know if I told you back in the day, but when I first was in the comedy group Straightjacket, we did a thing for BBC Radio 1. I used to be on about 1 o'clock in the morning, but it was with the composer Ozzy Mizo who did the original Blue Jam.
Oh wow!
So we were pretty psyched to say the least, you know.
I can imagine. Jesus.
But yeah, I love that kind of how that ambient thing, how it all kind of goes like in waves and stuff, and it's like a dreamlike, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a bit. If we're confessing to massive influences in things what we do, we've actually kind of just gone in the last 10 minutes. I think we've just kind of gone through all the people that I may have copied.
I think well, if you're gonna be influenced by someone, be influenced by the best at the end of the day.
Oh yeah, definitely.
You know, I caught a little bit of EastEnders the other day, and obviously I know you're a fan, but or you're forced into it either way. I love it. It's great. I've liked it on Facebook. Fine. But Michael French, you know, mentioned for Crime Traveller.
Jeff Slade,
And Bugs as well, obviously.
With Craig McLaughlin, yes.
Indeed.
But the 90s were a barren desert for genre tea with the towering exception of the X-Files.
And we had one as well, which was called Ultraviolet. That was pretty good.
Oh, yeah, and I didn't, yeah. Another example of something that I slept on at the time and then since rediscovered. And it's brilliant. And it's got String of Bell in it as well, before it was String of Bell, which equals awesome. The award-winning String of Bell.
What do you mean by String of Bell? I don't
String of Bell from The Wire.
I don't watch The Wire. Are you talking about Idris Elba?
Yes.
Oh, that's all right then. Yeah,
sorry,
mate.
We can gloss over this, but you can edit it.
Luther.
He's String of Bell. Yeah, oh, yeah, Luther. Yeah, Luther. He was Luther before he's Luther. No, he's bloody brilliant. And weirdly, your man out of True Blood, Bill Compton, whatever his name is.
Oh,
he's in,
yes.
He's in that. Yeah, he's the guy with the long hair. He's Jack Davenport out of This Life's Mate.
And I always thought that they would return to Ultraviolet because I thought a second series was very viable with that.
I think it's a weird Joe Ahern thing because he seems like he does six episodes of a really solid show and then he moves on. Like he did that and then he did Apparitions, much later with Martin Shaw, which was great. I felt a bit weird with it being as big an atheist as I am because it was like, you know, Christian propaganda, basically, but it was awesome Christian propaganda. And he did, of course, he did a couple of corkers for the first Russell T. Davis series of Doctor Who.
Of course, but
it just seems like he does like one series or something, kind of pretty much nails it, and then either it doesn't get commissioned again, or I'm sure I read somewhere about that maybe they hadn't intended to do another series, but I can't say that with any degree of authority.
And obviously, you just mentioned there, Jack Davenport, with This Life was obviously a very, very important film that merged kind of Portishead and stuff.
Yeah.
The soundtrack and stuff. And it was something that I think people have tried to copy since, the kind of format and stuff. And obviously, if you want to, I'll erase it from everyone's memory afterwards. But when they did the reunion episode as well, oh no! don't go back to stuff like that.
Well, because Ferdy cropped up in EastEnders recently. He's quite a vicious man.
All right.
Yeah. And I think Warren was in Midsummer Murders in the Nettles proper years.
Well, you know, they've obviously made their money and they obviously didn't need to go back, you know. And I just thought, you know, because it was such a brilliant show and to have them two series and then I don't know what ever happened to the Scottish woman out of it. You know, I can't remember her name.
She was in The Fades.
Was she really? All
she
right.
was the Lady Vicar.
All right, because I wondered if she was still, because I liked her. She was pretty good, you know, feisty.
The only one I don't think I've seen in anything since. Was she called Anna? No, the one with the dark hair, Egg's girlfriend. Because, of course, Egg's in The Walking Dead, isn't he?
He is indeed, yes. Yeah. Yes. Egg's girlfriend was in a few things a few years ago. I think there was a drama on ITV about something called The Tunnel or something. And there was some sort of crash in a train tunnel or something, and she was like a big part of it.
Is this The Last Train, or is this I'm thinking of something else? Because there was one. I think it was your man that did Life on Mars, wrote something for ITV.
That rings a bell.
Yeah, that was a cracker as well, which I didn't discover until much later. But The Last Train was amazing. It was really, really good.
It was written by Matthew Graham. Yeah.
Yeah. April 1996 to May 1999. So it's the 90s, and it counts.
In terms of films, I was talking to someone the other day and got on talking about Fight Club. I'm not watching that because it's shit. because for me, you know, that was the late 90s where I really started going to the cinema. I used to go to I didn't really go out that much in terms of drinking stuff. So I used to go to the cinema, the art cinema one night and go to the normal cinema another night.
Yeah.
And around the late 90s, you had stuff like, you had Fight Club, you had Blair Witch, Metal Psycho. It was a rich time, wasn't it, you know, for big films.
Like earlier in the 90s as well, there was Trainspotting that we touched on earlier, which kind of picked off a whole kind of revived British film. Every revived British film seemed to have to be some kind of like desperately urban, desperately realistic, drug-related thing. Do you remember the Adam and Joe show?
Yes.
They had the sketch about Speeding on the Needle Bliss. It was a drugs film they were making. And they were casting young ladies as gun bitches or something like that. I can't remember. I think it was Ken Corder. It was a Ken Corder sketch or something like that. I can't remember.
All right, because there was a time as well where everything had to be kind of very kind of spirited up north, sort of like it was kind of full Monty.
Full Monty, kind of parochial, little person triumphs over a thing, kind of lottery funded, yada, yada, yada. Yeah.
By the same token, Four Winds and a Funeral, massive film. It still stands the test of time, still good. You know,
it's all right, but it's just there's bits of it that kind of work, but I kind of resent it. I can see it's good, but I can grudgingly admit I quite like it because I'm a snob, basically. The problem's mine. I mean, the thing is, I should love it because it starts off with about 5 minutes of swearing. Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm gonna now go. I found a website, the greatest movies of the 90s. So I'll rock through them. Schindler's List, obviously. Goodfellas, Saving Private Ryan, Pulp Fiction, Silence of the Lambs, Fargo, Unforgiven, Shawshank Redemption, Malcolm X, American Beauty. There's just 10 for now.
Because we haven't talked about Tarantino, Reservoir Dogs.
No.
Big 90s thing.
Of course, yeah. It was obviously kind of a very kind of pastiche, and I think it kind of brought back people like John Travolta and stuff. I don't know if that's good or bad. I don't know.
It's good. It's the thing that we've discovered. I'd say me and a group of scientists that are basically me have discovered is that It's good if Tarantino is handling him. Actually, same goes for Uma Thurman, I'm afraid. Tarantino's at the reins, then he will get good performances out of these people, and they will be memorable and they will be good. But after that, they become famous again and they just do shit like Michael in the case of Travolta, or, you know, flying your big Scientology plane around, wherever it else is he does now. But yeah,
he's doing that. He does enjoy that.
Playing Zinu.
But in terms of other films, you've got stuff like American History X was quite an iconic, horrible scene. You remember when he smashed his head?
I've still not seen that one. I've got big gaps in it, but that's cool. Don't worry about it. No spoilers.
I'll just mumble over what happened there. But obviously, reinventing the horror genre was obviously with Scream, you know. Was absolutely amazing how the horror franchise was kind of just reinjected with this new kind of spunk, so to speak. Well, you know,
it was the whole, but that's a very 90s thing, isn't it? It's I did actually do a modicum of research before we came on here. Yeah. And Wikipedia claims that the 90s was the end of modernity and the beginning of the postmodern era, even though that postmodernism, apparently, according to Wiki, has been around since the 1940s in some, you know, just in clubs mainly, and in cars in people's front rooms. Yeah. But it's the beginning of the postmodern era, so everything's kind of slightly deconstruction-y and self-reflexive in that.
Well, I don't think you look no farther than Lars von Trier with his film The Idiots, which was out in the 90s, and that was weird.
That's the whole Dogma 95 thing.
That was a very bizarre movement. I remember going to the cinema and seeing that and thinking, what? and also, very late 90s, but I only saw it in the early 90s, was the Ringu trilogy stuff.
Oh, the proper Japanese ones.
They were kind of late 90s, early 90s, and they're just iconic, amazing stuff, you know. I think they've kind of, they still stand the test of time and still scary as hell.
Oh, the first Ringu is an amazing film, and probably it's going to look a bit pat to people going back to it now, because seemingly every other Japanese horror, and for a while every other Western horror film, copied it and took elements from it. I mean, like the whole kind of stays now, like the Sadako character is kind of like a bit of a kind of a cultural archetype. Like, she turns up and somebody dressed up as her on stage with like Odd Future on Jimmy Fallon doing sandwiches, you know, in between the garden gnomes and the guy playing the tuba. But yeah, the first Ring film, bloody, really, really powerful stuff, especially if you can get your phone to ring after the DVD extras played.
In terms of comedy, one of them that listed here is number 100 is Clerks, the Kevin Smith film.
Yeah, like probably the most satisfying of his films, really, because he wasn't Kevin Smith, the big loudmouth internet bloke. Then he was just Kevin Smith, the guy making films that he wanted to make with his friends, and there's kind of a purity to that. That, well, I quite like Dogma, I have to say. I'm one of the three or four people that like Dogma.
I think it's, you know, a film's going shit when Alanis turns up.
As God.
You're like, oh, Alanis, seriously, get out of town, you know.
You ought to know.
Being John Malkovich as well. That's a mad film. That's just brilliant. You know, it's like, if you imagine pitching that to someone.
Yeah, I suppose it's kind of like, maybe it's another period, because like the 1970s was kind of similar. Loads and loads of mad films that you kind of wonder how the hell they got made. And yeah, definitely Being John Malkovich is one of that ilk.
It always seems to be, when I'm looking here, it seems to be 98, 99. A lot of good films seem to come around. Like Magnolia came out and Eyes Wide Shut as well. And then a lot of people are like, ooh, Eyes Wide Shut, blah, blah. But I think there's some nice moments in Eyes Wide Shut, even though it's a film with Rudy stuff in, you know?
Yeah. I kind of came to it quite sort of part of the way through. And so my opinions of not liking it kind of don't really count, because I didn't see it from the beginning. And I think you have to kind of have seen something all the way through, or like started with it and kind of realised you didn't like it to be able to get a real handle on it. So yeah, watch me backtrack. But but yeah, I kind of there are things about it that are absolutely beautiful, but I just didn't really get it. And I think it might have been the Tom Cruise thing as well, but I don't know.
And another thing that people didn't really get, which should have been left where it was the Matrix. So
Yeah. Again, it's another example of first attempt cracking because you didn't have a precedent and you weren't trying to live up to something. And then the two subsequent sequels made back to back, like in the shadow of and on the back of this massive thing that you achieved the first time around. And it goes belly up. I really liked Men in Black.
Oh, wow. That's a one I wasn't expecting. I don't know if it made the list. I don't know if it did.
I think it might be somewhere like sort of lower 70s, maybe. I don't know, but I enjoyed it. I'm in my chief memory of it. It's like basically we lived in Turnpike Lane in North London at the time. And they had non-multiplex cinemas as well. So it went this real flea pit. It's basically there's like just people just sitting like all over places smoking in the cinema, not that you're allowed to. I remember my chief memory of Men in Black, other than like really enjoying the film, was that basically like three police officers came in, went to the dude three rows down from us, picked him up and pulled him out. I think you've been selling drugs in the toilet. And then we just carried on watching the film. Bill and Ted's Excellent.
Yes,
Bogus Journey definitely was. And Terminator 2, that was 90s, so it was very early 90s.
Yeah, it was 91. Yeah, I've just seen that. And again, there's another one that kind of peaks and then they kind of keep having to do more and more, don't they? And then it's like, oh.
Gonna leave it alone, really. You've got kind of good examples of it that it doesn't really need anybody else's hands on it, because given that most of the people that are originally involved aren't involved anymore.
Well, going back to TV for a second as well, I think Twin Peaks was early 90s as well.
Yeah, it was. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And I don't know if it was but in summary, do you think it was an interesting time? Do you think it were kind of it evolves culture and stuff?
I very soft spot for it, really, because it was unlike going back to the beginning of the conversation. It kind of felt like the decade when I first became alive to a lot of things.
Hmm.
So how could I not really kind of love it? It seemed sort of culturally in a similar place to where what you hear about the 90s, not having lived through it, but what you hear about the 1960s in relation to the 1950s, and the 1950s are kind of post-war austerity, and it seemed quite a conservative decade. They weren't entirely, and then the 60s was something a little bit more extravagant, and I wonder if not this decade but the decade after might kind of be the same, might be similar, because we're in the middle of a financial mess, and just quite austere conservative times. I'm guessing like not this 10 years coming up, but the 2020s are going to be pretty ace, if you know.
Well, the thing is as well, you know, obviously one of the biggest things was dial-up internet as well.
The very reason that we're talking now.
Yeah, you know, it's like, because you know, I would check my email once a day. I would check it after 6 o'clock, obviously cheaper time.
Look at hotbot.com, the search engine, I hasten to add.
And obviously, you know, hey, do you want this? Oh yeah, what is it? It's something on a floppy disk, and like, all right, fair enough. And you know, it's like, you know, and you it's got like, oh, do you want to play this game? Yeah, it's on 8 or 9 floppy disks. It's like, but yeah, so it makes you kind of very thankful for what you've got now. You know?
Absolutely. Well, actually, I mean, like, weirdly, I'm kind of the room I'm sitting in at the moment. We've still got the first computer that my then girlfriend, now wife, and I got. It's an iMac, because we had managed to get hold of a little bit of money at the time, around about 1999, and she bought us one of the old boiled sweet iMacs. And that was like the first time we kind of had the internet at home. I'd had a bit of university and stuff, but it was all text-based browsers, and it wasn't really particularly appealing to use. But like the iMac, kind of the last great invention of the 90s, made using computers kind of intuitive and really enjoyable.
And look where we are now.
Absolutely,
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
We've come so far. It's just like, Jesus, you know, because like, it, when you see stuff on like IT Crowd and stuff, and he's talking about, you know, he used to take like 3 hours to see a girl's chest, you know. I don't know if that was a phrase he used, but you know, and I think it's interesting because that's obviously not the only use. It's all the uses, you know.
It's discussing like science fiction shows, you know. That's the other use. But
obviously, yeah, yeah. But it's just bizarre that you can now kind of download an album of a band in, like, I don't know, 2 or 3 minutes or something like that, you know. Whereas before, it was like this thing of that's one of the big things for me with the 90s, was going to independent record shops and buying music and stuff.
Yeah.
It was an exciting time, you know. Like, and I think now we're the thing where record shops and all that are just not important, other than the people, you know.
Well, if you can, yeah, I mean, that's if you can kind of find one, and that's a sad thing. It's like it's easier to get hold of things, but you kind of without wanting to sound like I'm polishing my medals and, you know, being a bit of an old git about it, there's like, I don't know, there's not a sense that you've earned what you find, but you had to kind of dig a little harder. I mean, that said, if I had the technology when I was like, you know, when I was 14, 15, now to find and actually make music, then, you know, of course, sort of done it straight away. But I'm kind of quite proud of the fact that you still kind of like had to do a little bit of digging to get something good.
Yeah, you know, and if you found it, I remember news groups as well, they were quite a 90s thing as well. You know, if you like the band, you're like, oh, I'll just go on the Alt Manson news group or something.
Before Facebook pages, getting stuff from Twitter and that, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, you know, and it's like it's bizarre, but yeah. So all in all, I think it was a time of kind of. I think you have to always relate it to your life as well. I think that's the most important thing.
Yeah.
Like, you know, lots of things that might have happened and all, but if you're not the age to kind of be receptive to it, then it just passes you by. You know, I mean, not every kid's going to be queuing up at Forbidden Planet to get the Doctor Who movie. You know, 1996, but. It was a big thing at the time, you know, for us Whovians. But you know, but yeah, do you want to tell people about Soldiers of Tangent and all?
Yeah,
that?
Oh yes, Soldiers of Tangent, which is me and my showbiz pal, Mr. Marty Perrett, who and we basically kind of talk sillies for about an hour, and then I have to go and help put my baby to bed, and then we release it on the internet for people to listen to. It's available at www.soldiersoftangent.co.uk. Just realised I should have perhaps mentioned it's a comedy show, not just two grown men. Well, it is kind of just two grown men acting like the giddy goats that they are, but it's with the intention of raising mirth rather than anything else.
You have a fun night, and thank you again for your company.
And again, always a pleasure, mate. Take it easy.
Take care.
Cheers.
Bye.